This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerall. Are you ready to discover your True North story?
We like to find from our guests like you some words of encouragement, inspiration, motivation, and even hope. I know that you have written a book and that you have an incredible life journey that you've been on, starting with your childhood. Can you tell us, Anne, just a little bit of your story and how it got started?
Well, my book is called Starved, A Nutrition Doctor's Journey from Empty to Full. And what I'm hoping that people can get from this is the realization that even though so many people struggle with their weight and with controlling their weight or losing weight if they're overweight, and other people with food issues, that there are ways to get through it, and that even someone who's a researcher and a physician in this area has been through a lot of that and realizes that how difficult it is, but that there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
And you yourself have gone through quite a bit of struggle in your life. Can you tell us a little bit about maybe where you were born and what growing up was like for Anne?
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. My parents were separated before I was born. And so I was raised by a single mom and my aunt. They lived together. And there was no dad in my life. So, you know, we always were the three people in the family. And in those days, in the 50s, in the 60s, there wasn't much in the way of daycare, so my mother ended up sending me to a number of homes where I would be in a home for the entire week, and then I would just be home on weekends. And my story for for Starved starts with me being brought to a boarding school, a Catholic boarding school, at age 4 and a half. And that experience was just so devastating for me that I really starved over that year. I could have died. Luckily, there was a physician, our family physician, told my mother to get me out of that environment. But, you know, it really shows how the roots of eating issues can start quite early if you don't have the right kind of environment, the right kind of family environment.
Ian, so what age are we talking about when this started to appear in your life?
So I was 4 and a half years old when I was sent to this boarding school. And over that year, I was just so sad. I didn't thrive. I didn't eat.
Wow.
And so I lost weight. Little kids aren't supposed to lose weight. You know, give them a decent environment. They're going to grow, play, eat well.
Right.
And it
sure
didn't happen to me. You know, so I became very sickly and lost weight. So it was kind of like anorexia, but it was a little kid doing this. You know, I think what it says to me is that if somebody that food and nutrition is so important, both the emotional nutrition and physical nutrition is so important for people throughout their lives, and it starts in childhood.
What were your memories like, Anne, of living in that boarding school?
Well, some of them are very vivid. You know, remembering the other girls there. It was just girls that were in the boarding part. Remembering how difficult it was at night. The kids would be, some would be crying, or they just couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. So it's kind of really bad memories during that time, during that year. And, you know, I remember being abused by some of the older girls. But I also remember I got to go home on the weekends, and I remember being that such a nice feeling because I'd get to go home to my mother and aunt for the weekend. At least I had some comfort at that time.
So I bet Sunday evening going back to school was very difficult for you.
Exactly. It was a bad night. And for a long time, Sundays would bring things up like that. So it was kind of hard to get rid of those kind of memories.
How was your relationship with your family? Back up here a second and start with, why was the decision made to send you to boarding school to begin with? It's curious because then later on, I want to get into more of the emotional development related to what you say that the effect it has on diet, as well as working through the emotional growing up of childhood and then how it affects your diet as well.
My mother just wasn't meant for mothering. And I think the reason she sent me away, when she'd tell me later, that she sent me away both as a baby. So starting at age 3 months, I was sent to boarding homes. I think
she just couldn't deal
with mothering. And she, you know, I would wake her up at night. You know how kids cry at night, and it makes it difficult for the parents.
Sure.
But she couldn't deal with it and chose not to deal with it. So that, I think, is why she sent me away.
You know,
so as long as I was little and, you know, unable to control myself like little babies and toddlers and little kids do, I think that's what she chose to do.
But you were just being, you were a child. Can't be expected to be anything but that, but a child. Let's forward here a little bit, because I'm really interested in seeing, you know, the research that you conduct and how it affects diet and exercise and weight loss at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. You know, one of the big things that Tam and I talk a lot about is stress, and really hard to quantify what effect that has on your health, emotions, spiritual belief, you know, just all of that. What do you find when in the research that you're conducting on stress as it impacts diet and mental health and all of that, tied in with what you're with the research you're doing yourself?
If for somebody that's trying to make changes to lose weight or to eat better or to exercise, you know, they need a certain amount of psychic health and strength to do that, because it's very difficult to change behaviors. And, you know, especially food, it has some very deep-seated roots in each of us. And some of it could be related to your culture, what your family had for food, and some of it could be what you did for comfort. And so changing that is really challenging. And so we've done a lot of clinical trials where we get people to change their diet or change their physical activity or take medicine. And the diet one seems to be the most difficult of all the trials that we've done. And I've done ones, I've probably had more people in diet trials than other types of trials, but it's the most challenging. And part of it is really emotional eating is very difficult to change. It is changeable. We can help people. We can get them to change their behaviors, but it's challenging. And I think people need a lot of help doing that. And so I think just telling somebody, change your diet, lose weight, is not enough for most people.
You believe that it probably stems from something deep and emotional within them. And I know that for you, you not only were starving as a young child, but you also became quite indulgent in eating along the way in your life, too. Is that correct?
That's right. And, you know, part of that was from family examples. My mother and aunt, you know, tended to be on the overweight side, especially my mother, and used eating as a way to deal with emotional things. But then I would be on my own quite a bit after school. By the time I was age 7, I was on my own. And so I used food as comfort. I'd come home after school, and that would be what I would reach for, whatever would be there. There'd be nobody there to censor it. You know, if you had a parent around or a babysitter that might try to steer a child away from overindulging that way. But I didn't have that. So food became my companion, my comfort after school.
You know, I was just thinking, I don't know why, but it just hit me that, do you think there's a connection between technology today and food insofar as a companion piece, where people use technology, whether it be gaming or social media or watching YouTube videos, as a substitute for something that's missing, kind of like the way we do with food? We use food sometimes as a reward. I know I do myself. Or, hey, you know, you did something good, get a little piece of candy or something. I'm oversimplifying tremendously, but you understand where I'm going with that. Do you think that there are connections like that to our psyche, addictive tendencies, if you want to call it, between things like technology that make us feel good and food that makes us feel good and alcohol or substances that maybe allow us to escape and feel good?
Well, you know, I'm not sure about comparing one exactly to the other, comparing food to other types of addiction to social media, but there is a common denominator that if something makes you feel good, quite often it's because it increases dopamine in your brain. There are some positive ways to get your dopamine increased. Once I heard that if you compliment somebody, that increases their dopamine. That made me start thinking about complimenting people more often, because it's a very easy gift to give somebody.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, so there are other psychic kind of things that increase your dopamine, but often that is something that makes people want something of some kind, whatever their comfort, whatever their addiction is, and that keeps them going back for more.
How were your teen years for you, and personally?
Well, teen years after I've had two teenagers, and I know teenagers at years are very challenging. But you know, here I was in a single family, no dad. I was an only child, and so my teen years were, they started off very rough and then got much better. So, and I think part of that was just growing up and becoming, feeling more responsible for my own actions and for my own future, and realizing I could do some things for myself. I could make decisions. I could deal with my mother in ways to keep myself safe. And that's exactly what happened. I ended up getting control of my eating. I lost weight, got closer to friends, had a relationship with a boyfriend, and each of them really, I think, increased my confidence and helped me feel like I had some control.
I have a sister who is an internal medicine doctor, and so I know the stress and the hard work that you put into that, as well as a residency. And how did you find you were dealing with diet or food or those kinds of things in that stressful time of your life?
Well, I think that, you know, even though you never really get rid of the roots of an eating disorder, for me, it just never picked up the same way it did as a child. And so my body wants to be overweight, but I haven't been in the overweight or obese categories as an adult. But medical school was stressful because our children were small when I started. They were 7 and 3 years old. And so I had more stress than the typical medical student. On the other hand, I had some wonderful things to come home to, my children and my husband, and so that was very comforting. But certainly it was a difficult time, and when other students would be complaining that they didn't have enough time to study, I would just look at them like they couldn't even imagine what it would be like to try to be taking care of a family at the same time that you're going to medical school.
How did you decide that you wanted to go into the study of nutrition, diet, exercise, and the emotional piece of that as well?
Well, I think I kind of evolved towards that. When I finished residency, I loved practice. I would have really liked to have done practice full-time, seeing patients. I just loved being part of patients' lives and finding out about them and seeing how I could help them. But our kids were still young. They were 11 and 7 when I finished medical school, and then 14 and 10 when I finished residency. And so they still need a lot of mothering, and to do clinical medicine full time, that I would have had to still been away from home quite a bit. And so when I had the opportunity to do some research, then I jumped at that possibility. And at the time, I had done epidemiology, which is a research into people and populations. I'd done that years before, and one of the investigators that I'd known at that time told me about a potential study, which was called the Women's Health Initiative, and was interested in hiring me for that. And I really jumped at that opportunity because used my medical skills and used my research skills, but still be able to have some time at home with family. And that Women's Health Initiative was a large-scale set of clinical trials, including a very large diet trial. And then from there, I got interested in doing various other types of studies, looking at the effect of weight loss or physical activity on risk factors for cancer. So we'll get somebody to get women into a study, get them to change their diet, get them to lose weight through changing diet and increasing physical activity, and then see what happens to various parts of the biology to see if that can explain how changing behavior might improve and improve prognosis or reduce risk of getting cancer.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. And now, back to the program.
So now you've written several books. So what was that process like for you? I mean, obviously you've done the research, so you know you're comfortable, and you read here that you have done lots of different scientific manuscripts and things like that. Because Tam and I are huge proponents of story, obviously, with True North Story. And not only your life story, but also how you tell it through different media platforms, whether it be books or video or what have you. So what was that like? Walk us kind of through that, Anne, when you sat down and you said, I'm going to write the first book author Anne McKiernan. What was that process like?
One book that I published with two other co-authors about 15 years ago was a book about exercise health for related to breast cancer, and so it was a health book, but it was geared toward the general public. So it was very interesting. It was fun to do, but it was along the lines of the academic work that I had done and the research. What's different about Starved is that it's a personal story. It's creative nonfiction, and it's quite different from academic writing, from science writing. And when I decided I wanted to do that, you know, physicians often are trained to, we have the saying called see one, do one, teach one. You know, the physicians learn to very quickly learn how to do something and then do it on their own. I kind of had the thought that while I'd read some memoirs, I thought I could just write one. And it turns out you can't. It's a real process, and it really made me respect writers, professional writers, or people have spent many, many years learning how to write, learning how to be creative, learning what the story arc is, and learning how to show emotion and show change in the narrator. And so I loved it. I took courses, and I worked with editors, had mentors, and had friends that helped. And so it's really the sort of thing that, you just don't do it on your own. You just don't decide, I'm going to write a story.
It's very collaborative. You know, people think that the writer just sits down and writes, but there are a lot of other people that play roles that help in the success of that story coming off the page, so to speak. How long did all of that, did that take, Anne? Just kind of like from your initial concept of saying, hey, I might like to write, you know, a memoir type situation through getting it actual published this month of this year?
I'd say it's been about 6 years. And, you know, that a lot of that is that, you know, the publishing period takes time. But before that, you know, I really needed to learn. I wanted to learn. So I took courses over 2 years and then worked with a writing group and then worked with editors. And so, you know, I didn't even send the book out to agents until it really had been through quite a bit of vetting. And you know, I had been through quite a learning process.
It's definitely a labor of love, isn't it, Anne?
It is, but it's a labor of fun too. Doing creative writing and writing something as story, I think, is really important. And you know, one thing that I realized as I was going along, that physicians really do work in story. You just don't realize how to write it down. But when we do our case histories and we're presenting cases to a colleague, or in medical school you're presenting it to your faculty, we're doing everything as story. You're talking about the patient, and you're talking about their problem, what brings them in, and then you give some details, and then as you're working with a patient over time, then you have kind of an arc of the story, and you look at change. So the patient hopefully is getting better, and that is a little bit similar to what we see in developing a story for a book like this.
That's so interesting, because you think of medical as science. You think of it as very left brain, very analysis oriented, data oriented. But you're right. When you sit down with a physician for the first time, they want to know your history. And a lot of that comes from learning about family background and about environment and about your health is a reflection, I think, of who you are and what your life experience has been.
Exactly. The physician will, you know, unless they're working in an emergency situation and they have to deal with just what they're dealing with right at that time, they usually design and offer treatment plans based on what's appropriate for that patient. For somebody who lives in some environment, the treatment might not work for them that would work for somebody else. You know, some of it's just a cost thing, but some may be, you know, what if you had a patient in a rural area? Do you really want to ask them to do something where they're coming into a hospital or clinic every day? So you really try to work around what somebody's life is like. And, you know, often we'd have patients come in the hospital, and one of the first things we'd do is start to working with a social worker to see what can we do about this patient when they're leaving the hospital. So I think everything is always based on the patient. You know, another parallel to medicine that I was thinking about is that when we're trained in medicine to always think of the patient first. You know, even the most, even physicians that are really focused on making a good living, making a lot of money, they still come back to the patient first. And we would hear this over and over again. What's most important is what the patient wants and needs. And, you know, I think the same is true when you're writing a book or creative writing like this. You know, you have to think of the reader. You know, the point where you're trying to write something and present it to somebody who's going to read it, you're writing it for the reader.
What sorts of messages are you hoping that the readers of Starved will take away?
Well, I'm hoping that they see it as a book about inspiration and hope, that they see that somebody came from a, you know, impoverished, deprived childhood can get through that and come out the other side and just is fine. And, you know, so I have a wonderful life now, wonderful husband and daughters and grandchildren. And, you know, I've had a very satisfying career. And so, you know, I think that message that even hard times can get better.
That's great. I just wanted to ask, you know, we talked about the process of writing Starved. It was different than earlier books that you wrote, but was that a cathartic process? Was there healing in that, in just for you personally as you wrote it? Because a lot of times when you write about your own situations or you meld that into the story arc, what was that like for you and as a healing or not healing process?
Yeah, I would say that quite a bit of it was healing in some ways, because if you're writing something in a way to present it to somebody else and make it a story and make it interesting, then all of a sudden some of the, you know, the difficult part seems less difficult.
Right.
The first part starts sad because I'm being sent away to a boarding school at age 4 and a half, whereas by the end it's much more uplifting and hopefully people see some humor in it in various places. And so I've had people say that, you know, they got tearful in the beginning of the book. But mm-hmm. for me, the part that's tearful is when I think of the very end, the epilogue, when I'm talking about my own family and how important they are and how much they mean to me. That's the part that makes me feel tearful now, because those tears are joy, really.
Right, because it's almost like coming out the other side, and this is the end result. I mean, of all of this arc from the beginning, and then this is the beauty of where it is now. It gets me just thinking about it, because writers tend, for the most part, to like happy endings, and I think we as Americans like happy endings. That certainly usually bears out in movies that we like and things of that nature, and books that, not always, but most, we like comebacks, people who, you know, the underdog. I love to hear that, because it's so healthy to think about where you are and your family, and that you've been able to instill those things, those values in your own children. And now you're a grandparent, so they have children. I mean, there's a real legacy there.
Exactly, and it's a wonderfully satisfying feeling, too. You know, it's also wonderful for me to see my daughters, the two children we have, we're both girls, so they're both mothers now, and it's just fantastic to see what great mothers they are.
That has to be tremendously fulfilling. That's fantastic.
Did you have any worries, Anne, about being a mother yourself after having maybe a less than perfect childhood?
Oh, I think I worried about it every day, yes. you know, it was definitely a challenging. Am I doing the right thing? And, you know, I was always surprised when they seemed to love me. And you know, it was like, it was wonderful. So I loved being a mother. Yeah, I felt like I really didn't know what I was doing. And I learned from friends. I learned from my husband, because he came from a very solid family where the family was together forever. And so that was helpful.
So what are you doing these days, Anne? What fills up your days?
Oh, I'm still very busy with research. I have quite a few things going on. We have studies still going on, and I'm part of some advisory committees. For example, the United States Physical Activity Guidelines Committee is ongoing now to give advice to the government of what physical activity effects there may be and what types of activities and how much people should be doing. So I was on the committee that met 10 years ago, and so now we're redoing these. And it's similar to the dietary guidelines that happen every 5 years, but these are the physical activity guidelines. So that's keeping me busy. And because I'm a senior researcher, I tend to do quite a bit of advising, consulting, going around and giving talks. And then I do an awful lot of babysitting. So, yeah, so my husband and I are taking care of grandchildren here after school, so we tend to split that daycare after school. And then as often as I can, I get to see my other daughter and my grandson and do a lot of babysitting there, too.
That's wonderful.
Oh, that's fantastic. Just real quick, and kind of in closing, Anne, I wanted to ask, Tam and I are big about extrapolating themes that are similar between our guests and So I always just like to ask the question, what is one thing, one prominent thing that kind of sticks out in your life that is intricate to your True North journey? Something you've learned or something that really stands out in your life that we could share with our audience about your story that could make their life better? That's a loaded question.
Yeah, because I'm thinking there's just so many different things.
Whatever comes to, just aspirational, inspirational.
I think that for a person that's dealing with some kinds of challenges, I think that by getting help from other people, that helps bring you strength, but that the people can think that they have more strength themselves than they realize, that we're not individuals, we're not islands, we can't do things on our own completely, but that we do have a lot of inner strength, and that can help you harness help, get assistance from other people, and that way you can overcome your issues and then continue on and really have a very fulfilled life.
What do you do for fun, Anne?
Well, taking care of grandchildren. but I'm big on physical activity, so I'm out walking at least an hour a day. And what I tend to do is I'll go out with friends in the morning. We usually are up and out by 7:30 in the morning and doing a walk. Here in Seattle, we have a lot of green areas we can walk in. On the weekends, I'll do it with my husband. Occasionally, we'll do some other things like hiking.
Yeah, physical activity is important. Are you finding that in revamping the government requirements for healthy exercise that things have changed in 10 years?
Well, I think there's more information. There's a lot more data. And, my job there is mostly dealing with cancer, but we're looking at all kinds of health outcomes of physical activity. I think we'll be able to give a little more information to the American public about what kinds of activity may help. But one thing that's changed greatly in the last 10 or 20 years is the amount of sedentary behavior that we're all dealing with. The amount of time we're spending sitting at a computer or watching television or commuting, sitting down or sitting with our smartphones. And so I think everything's general life and jobs have changed in that way to become more sedentary. So we may need some little extra push to be a little more active in other ways to kind of overcome that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember the requirements at one point were like 20 minutes of exercise, at least, like maybe 3 or 4 times a week. Are you thinking that may change?
Well, I can't say what the overall guidelines are going to do, but those recommendations were back when people were still more active in their daytime. You didn't order out food if you wanted food. You cooked it at home, and that was a certain amount of work there. And people's jobs were more active. You had to get up and walk around your office and go meet somebody instead of just sending an email. And people may have been more likely to walk to a bus rather than getting in the car and driving. So those recommendations were in the setting of a much more active population.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
How we've become kind of sedentary. I think technology, to your point, has kind of made it more convenient, and yet we have become a little bit more lazy in getting up and moving.
Yeah, so I think we have to build activity into our lives in other ways.
We could become mentally healthy when we're moving our bodies as well.
Yeah, there's some evidence that it may help you think a little better, keep you a little more awake.
I was just thinking the same thing. That's why I'm heading to the gym every, other day, so that I can try and keep the blood moving.
Uh-huh, that's great.
Thank you, Anne, so much for being part of our True North story. If people want to learn more about you or find your book, do you have a website or a place for them to go?
The website is annemctiernan.wordpress.com. So it's annemctiernan.wordpress.com.
And there they will find your blog, I'm sure, and information about your book, Starved, and
That's
other
right.
interesting things.
And the book can be found at independent bookstores, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at the publisher's website, Central Recovery Press. So lots of ways to find it and purchase it.
Well, we can't wait to read it ourselves and share it
Absolutely.
With those around us. And we will have a link on our website so people can go purchase it with just one click.
That's great.
Well,
fantastic.
We are excited for you, Anne, and for all of the good things that are going to be coming your way soon and already are.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.